mentioned that I've had a couple of good conversations with Dr. Smith. I really haven't ever had a chance to interact much with him, being in Alabama, but and me being in Louisiana. But well, they may have loaded up, Dr. Smith. But recently found out that Dr. Smith is probably going to be easing on into retirement here soon.
Yeah.
And so I want to congratulate him on a job well done at Auburn. And I had caught wind of this sometime, and that's really the reason I wanted to get you on this podium, was to get you one last opportunity to serve with some of these guys on a stage like this and teach them a few things.
Well, I'm honored to be here with them. And I made some notes just as soon as you called me this summer when I was in the heat of the battle, so I'd like to kind of make sure I don't leave out any important points here. But my comments today is going to be based on what I saw and heard from about 500,000 acres in Alabama. But in reality, my insect situation on most pests are not very different from Georgia and Panhandle of Florida, which means that that's about 2 million acres that I'm kind of trying to cover here for most of the pests. There would be some exceptions. But the first point I want to make is that we had extreme variability in insect pressure in Alabama from region to region this year, and sometimes even with certain species of insects, even from field to field on the same farm. So in my 47 years of extension entomologist at Alabama, and I do hope to make one more, I've never experienced a year where insect monitoring was more important. It was not uncommon for adjacent fields to require drastically different insect management inputs in 2019. So I'd like to just kind of walk through with some of the pests like the others have done now and see what we might could take from that into the 2020 season. Thrips migrated from wild hosts unusually late in 2019, about as late as we've ever seen and about as the highest numbers we've ever seen. It really didn't even start to about mid-May, and it continued for several weeks after that. And that was after a real wet spring, and then we got into an extremely dry period with high temperatures. But our later planted cotton encountered the heaviest pressure, but the early planted cotton got enough pressure where we were still making some thrips applications on that cotton up to about the ninth true leaf. And that's a lot longer, but they were still that heavy on it. And we had more than two on some. And I would want to add here that the thrips predictor model developed at North Carolina State University was highly accurate in predicting this late thrips movement into cotton, and it's going to help us a lot in future years. That model changed dramatically in a two-week period when it sensed that we were moving into that dry period because it was monitoring weather stations. So the only thing I would say there is if we're going to use acephate for thrips control, we need to make it early and get away from it if we're making multiple applications, because the more applications you make and the later you make, the more you're going to aggravate the spider mite situation. This extended dry period also had something to do with our plant bugs. Lots of times we get a dribbling effect over a long period of time, but because of the drought this year, it caused an early and heavy movement of adult plant bugs into cotton. And one thing you got to remember here is in Alabama and most of the Southeast, I believe, daisy fleabane is our primary wild host that they're moving from. And that's very sensitive to heat and drought. So when it dries down, there's nowhere else to go but cotton. Now, I would add this, that most of our state and most of our state and the Southeast, we can still suppress immature plant bugs fairly well with pyrethroid chemistry. That's not to say that's our first choice, but when we get to fighting plant bugs, diamond is a real key ingredient in our program. Aphid pressure varied a lot from south to north in the state. It's very light in the northern part of the state, but very heavy in the southern part, and so a lot of these heavy aphid infested fields did receive foliar treatments, and it's not because of the concerns about the virus disease that's transmitted by aphids, but because a lot of these fields were planted into June, and were under heavy drought stress pressure, or drought stress at the time the aphids were peaking. And the only point I want to make about the aphids then is, as far as I could see in my sentinel plots, there was little or no impact between the aphid numbers and the incidence of the cotton leaf or old dwarf virus disease. So about all we found out with their sentinel plots there, what I saw was that you really can't get total control of aphids with insecticides. We had as many as 8 sprays on some sentinel plots, and all we got out of it was a heavy spider mite infestation. And I will mention spider mites again. You know, spider mites, I go back into the 60s as a cotton scout, and the mites are an old historical pest of cotton. Their impact in cotton, from looking back, was very minimal during the era of Aldicarb, if you'll think back, 1970 till it phased out. But at present, we're dealing with them in most all fields, up and down all season long, depending on the weather conditions and what the field has been sprayed with. Sometimes some things are aggravate mites more than others. So they're just basically waiting there, waiting now for a hot, dry period to increase or flare in our cotton. Moving on to escape boll worms on our 2-gene cotton. I don't see anything escaping on the 3-gene, but 2019 was our second consecutive year where the escape boll worms were extremely low over most of the state and most of the southeastern U.S. But boll worm moths began depositing eggs in low numbers in early bloom around early July, and that continued in low numbers up until about mid-August, so much the same trend as what we saw in other states. The number of eggs and the number of escape larvae were really never enough at one time to pull the trigger or get excited about. At harvest time, when we did worm damage boll counts on our 2-gene cotton, we were running 0 to 1 or 2% worm damage bolls in most fields. Last pest I want to talk about, and I've saved our biggest pest for last, and that's the stink bug complex, the most economically damaging pest for us in the southeast for the recent years, and I don't see anything that's really going to change that, maybe on an individual field basis, but overall it's going to be the stink bug complex, and that does now include, in addition to the brown and primarily the southern green, it includes the brown marmorated stink bug, and also this leaf-footed bug, the Leptoglossa species. They overwintered in high numbers, and we had a lot of brown stink bugs in cotton even prior to bloom. But we can't relax when we got stink bugs in cotton post-bloom, because they will damage thumbnail-sized bolls and not wait for the larger bolls. But this brown marmorated stink bug now can be found in cotton pretty much throughout the state. They continue to be heavy border feeders, concentrating on the heaviest on the first 50 foot or so into the field from the borders. This pest is going to present a major problem in future years, particularly in smaller fields like 10 to 20 acre fields that are scattered throughout the farmscape in our state. And in 2019, these smaller fields required a stink bug spray every 10 to 14 days from early bloom to maturity. And growers that are spread over multiple counties are just not going to be able to get around to some of those 10 to 20 acre fields that often. So that's going to present a real problem. The leaf-footed bug, which damaged bolls just like the stink bug complex does, were present in fields then pretty much statewide in August. We traditionally deal with them on the Gulf Coast, southern counties, but this year they were all the way north to the Tennessee line. We have observed, and consultants and others that observed in past years, that the pyrethroid chemistry, which we primarily use on stink bugs, is not adequate at all on the leaf-footed bugs. So we tried to alert folks to that fact, and we switched over, and Bivrin was a product of choice for the stink bug complex in August. So I don't see anything in summing that will change the fact that stink bug complex is probably going to be our most damaging pest, unless something changes dramatically. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. And I kind of like the way this panel played out position-wise. That we've got a
Go Tigers.
Clemson entomologist sandwiched between two LSU guys right now, so I think it's quite fitting if you ask me.
Hopefully it's a good game. All right, it's hard to follow this crowd because you've already heard just about everything I'm going to say, but I'll give you my perspective from South Carolina. We'll start with Thrips at the beginning of the season. It was very hot and very dry planting and seedling season for us. In fact, May was the hottest May on record for South Carolina. It was really hot. And we hit 100 degrees many days in May. Some of the heaviest Thrips pressure that I've seen in my years, been doing this for not as long as Ron, but for a long time now. Some of the heaviest pressure I've ever seen. From some of my trial work, the InfraOil products worked considerably better than the seed treatments. We got about a week out of the seed treatments, and then they were pretty much gone at 14 days. One seed treatment, I put acephate on the seed myself. Can't see me over on that side of the room. Put acephate on the seed myself, and it looked really good. And in 2013, we had a hot, very hot, dry planting season and seedling season, and acephate worked great in that year. So I think acephate and the water solubility, if you have just enough water, gets it in the root zone, it looks pretty good in a dry year. The in-furrow acephate also looked good. As far as the foliar products, Radiant, Orthene, Bidron were our best foliar products. And then the BT ligase trait looks pretty good on reducing thrips injury. As far as aphids, again, it was some of the heaviest pressure I've seen with aphids in some time. That was around the late June into July window. This cotton leaf roll dwarf virus is certainly getting more attention, something that we surveyed for in our state. We found it pretty widespread in all the counties we looked in. It wasn't on all of the plants that we chose that had some sort of symptomology, which, by the way, is all over the board. If you attend the session tomorrow, you'll probably see some of the photos. There's a lot of different symptoms of that. Crinkled leaves called rugosity, curling, drooping, reddening of the stems and leaves. You can take some of the leaves and crunch them with your hands, and they sound like paper crunching. So, you know, it's just all over the board. Dr. Philip Roberts is going to give a talk tomorrow about some of our insecticide trial work with aphids, and we have a lot of products that can kill aphids. That's not a problem. What we think is going to be the problem is that you're probably not going to do any good in terms of preventing the virus. It takes about 40 seconds to transmit the virus. So you're going to spray every 40 seconds? No. So I think that's the problem. And then there's a period where the aphids are just flying. They're just moving around, and you're not going to be able to prevent the virus by spraying for aphids, I'm afraid. Plant bugs, primarily Tarnished plant bug for us. We do have some cotton flea hopper and some clouded plant bugs. In some survey work we did across the state, we do have problem fields with tarnished plant bug in South Carolina, but for the most part, they're not an economic pest for us across the board. I had a handful of trials where I sprayed Transform at 2 ounces at first bloom, and then I had an untreated check. I took yields on those 5 trials, and there were no differences in yields. That's where I could, easily do that work on the experiment station. So we probably don't need that BT trait for ligase in South Carolina, but we can certainly use it for thrips. As far as bollworm, some of the lowest pressure I've seen in my research plots with bollworm happened in 2019, but we do have reports of bollworms getting through the 2-gene products across the state. Of course, corn is driving that with some of the similar traits, and we'll just have to work through that over the years. Some of our resistance monitoring with pyrethroid insecticides, we've continued to do that over the years, show that pyrethroids are certainly is not as good as they used to be on controlling escape bollworm in cotton, but we've got to have pyrethroids in the tank for stink bugs. They just have to be there. So we're hoping we get some of the escape bollworms with pyrethroids. And they're still semi-effective for us for that strategy. The best timing for spraying anything for bollworms is the first and the second week of bloom in a lot of our work, and that does coincide a lot of the times with egg pressure. Stink bugs, as Ron said, that's our number one insect pest group of cotton in South Carolina, and soybeans for that matter. We saw huge populations of stink bugs in corn last season, and then I think it got so hot and dry that we just didn't see that population translate as thick as it was in corn and a lot of our cotton acreage. We still had some problems with stink bugs in cotton and had to address that, but they weren't as bad as they could have been had we had considerable consistent rain. As I mentioned, pyrethroids or pyrethroid plus something like Bidrin or Orthene is the best foliar option for us. I did some work years ago where illustrated that you can get almost a week's worth of residual with a pyrethroid on some of our major species, so we got to have the pyrethroid in tank for stink bugs. The dynamic boll injury threshold research that we did years ago is still the best thing going for monitoring and managing stink bugs in the crop. I'm not going to say anything else about spider mites. We'll see if there are any more questions. That's
it. Good job, guys. Just hang on with that mic right quick. That was perfect. We've got 15 minutes left, and so I am going to open it up to the audience now. You've got a great opportunity to pick the brains of some fine entomologists, and so does anybody have any questions or ideas they would like to share?
I always hate to ask you to predict something, but from what you saw last...
1 second.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3.
I hate to ask you to predict something, but based on what you saw that year, does that help you develop some program that you would recommend to farmers for 2020?
Let me just say this. I like to always go into the season with a plan, but due to planting date and weather conditions, you have to adapt your plan as you move through the season. So that's what makes entomology and insects so interesting. You're driving the ship as you move.
For the Mid-South, our bollworm pressure was pretty... it was very low. I would say it was not what we normally expect. And being scouting eggs every day, every other day, looking to see, are we going to hit threshold? Are we going to do this? I'd much rather see just distinct bollworm flights. Not that I'm preparing for that because we can't predict the weather, but it is nice to, especially for growers too, because they know the eggs are here. You know, do I need to spray or this is what I can expect? So the uncertainty with bollworms, I don't want to see that in 2020. I'd like to see, but like Ron said, it's kind of you just adapt as things come at you as during the summer as being an entomologist.
So, with the problems we're seeing with resistance, BT resistance with bollworm, one of the things we really would ask you to be cognizant of is particularly if you're seeing any kind of injury or in worms coming through the 3-gene cotton. If it's a VIP cotton, that's something that we're all vitally interested in seeing. And I know across Texas and the Mid-South, we're starting to see some injury in Leptra corn, which is a VIP corn. So, we've picked up resistant genes to VIP technology. We're not seeing it manifest in control failures, but we have picked up the gene. But that's something we all need to be cognizant of. And as this moves along, we don't know how fast it's going to evolve. And, the VIP technology might last for 10 years, but we just don't know that. But if you see a case where you get unusual survivorship, in the VIP technology, we'd like to know about it, and we'd like to get collections out of that and see if we can figure out what's going on.
Well, I've been predicting insect problems for years and years and years, and I've never been right. If I've been right once, and that's red-banded stink bugs and soybeans, and if it don't get a lot colder, we're going to have a problem this year. But that's different.
That's because we told you.
Yeah, we got that from Seeb.
That.
That's the only thing Seeb's contributed to me in a long time. But It's difficult. It's really difficult to predict the insect problems. You know, you get these calls from whoever, investors and everybody else that always wants to know, hey, what do you think? It's been a warm winter. It's been a cold winter. How's this going to affect? And you can make some generalizations, but the spring may have just as much to do with it as the actual winter. If you get a terribly cold winter, kills a lot of insects, you have a really great spring with a lot of rain, a lot of wild hosts, that little population that made it through over winter can blow up every bit as big or bigger than it was to start with. So it's extremely difficult, you know, to make these predictions on what's going to happen. I think we're just going to be ready for the usual suspects, you know. Spider mites, plant bugs, thrips, boll worms. Yeah, maybe I missed something there, aphids, but we're going to be ready for the usual suspects.
Any other questions? Go ahead, Mr. Jack. Howard, just say.
You made the comment back in the 70s when we had albicarb that we did not have any problems much with spider mites. Well, I've had a lot of growers that's gone back to albicarb over the last 3 or 4 years. They hope it stays around because they won't ever leave it again. Where we used albicarb in the past several years, we have not sprayed the first fill with an overspray for thrips. Where we've had albicarb in the fur, we have had no spider mites to treat. And neighbors down the road did have spider mites. And even at first bloom, if you have a row that gets stopped up in an insecticide box, you can see it at first bloom, and it's probably a foot, foot and a half difference in deal. But according to the boll worms over, and I'm right across the river from Alabama, I got cotton on the river. But according to the boll worms, this was the lightest year that we saw because we made very few oversprays on Bollguard 2. Bollguard 2 has never been what I called 100% on corn earworms. We have a lot of peanuts in the area and corn, and it's irrigated corn, and we have to spray our peanuts. But Bollguard 2, you know, we've always had to overspray a majority of the Bollguard 2, but we've made very few sprays this year. I reckon it was just a light year because we're looking forward to the VIP deal. What concerns me with the VIP problem is all these corn varieties that's got it. You know, tobacco budworm used to be our big problem. Well, even with the Bollguard 1, now there's tobacco budworms in cotton are non-existent. I was hoping maybe with the VIP 3 or Bollguard 3 that would become a fact with the Bollguard cotton. But I was just wondering what was your take on that. But it looks like to me that enough growers are not what I've seen in my area. Growers, even if they're not our growers that have ever gone back to albicarb, they don't want to leave it again, even whatever it takes. And we're using no seed treatments. We're just taking the regular fungicide treatment from the factory to heck with the other. And we can offset some of the cost that way.
5 pounds?
We're using four.
Four, okay.
Jack, I probably one of the few in the room that can go back prior to 1970, but I was a cotton scout in the Tennessee Valley area of northern Alabama in the mid-60s, and it was not uncommon at all to see entire fields defoliated from spider mites in late season. So it was kind of a common thing. Mites were a huge problem back then that went away for about 30, 40 plus years. That's what I relate to.
When y'all see escapes and treat boll worms, what are y'all sticking with pyrethroids or are you moving on?
What's the question now?
When you're having to treat for boll worms.
Well, we still get pretty good suppression in Alabama on boll worm species. And plus, with the stink bug being so dominant, it's real valuable to have a pyrethroid in the tank mix. So if we did switch to the new chemistry, we would still have to have a pyrethroid along with it for the stink bug. So, you know, we're going to milk the pyrethroids on the corn earworm species as long as they'll work. And right now we think we're still getting adequate pressure. I've talked with Philip Roberts, and I think Philip would agree in the same thing in Georgia. So we'll just ride it as long as we will because that's a very economical treatment compared to the alternative. We'll switch when we have to. We recognize the advantages, the how effective, particularly on the egg stage, that the neurochemistry is.
Angus, you want to chime in on that?
I think you got to be real careful about geographical differences, for sure. Pyrethroids may work well in some places. In our area, they do not. I'm not saying we never treat a bollworm flight in cotton with a pyrethroid, but it's generally going to be after a diamide. If we have another really big flight within the time that we still are expecting to see some residual from the diamide, and it's never by itself. It always has acephate with it. The combination of acephate and the pyrethroid does a little for us. It does not last long at all, but we would never recommend coming out of the gate, at least in our area. Maybe in the hills of Mississippi we could get away with it a little bit, but we still ain't recommending it. We've been burnt too many times, and I'm just looking for consistency. So the diamides are really our go-to. Maybe some Intrepid Edge in some situations, but that's going to be where we start, or at least where we recommend starting. And we'll fill in the gap a little bit with pyrethroid acephate as needed.
Yeah, it's the same in Texas. And there's areas of Texas you can certainly get by with using a pyrethroid, but a lot of areas we have resistance to the pyrethroid. And then in most of the time, this year was a little bit of an exception, but most of the time you really, when you're targeting that bollworm, you need something that's going to give you a residual, a lot more than you're going to get out of just that pyrethroid application. And that's why the products like Prevathon and Besiege are so popular, because that's going to give us several, 2-3 weeks, you know, of activity. Whereas the pyrethroid, you spray it, and it's, you know, essentially in 4 days, there's nothing much left. The other thing is, you know, it's all risk management. If you got resistance, I mean, maybe you do, maybe you don't, you spray that pyrethroid. Well, by the time you figure it out, then you got a bigger worm. That thing's moved down the canopy. You're going to have a harder time picking them up with something that's more effective like a Prevathon. And then so you end up chasing these worms, and you probably got other eggs coming right behind it. It's a little risky in our geography to use the pyrethroid.
Did we have another question in the back, Mr. Don?
I've heard Philip talk fairly often about his concerns with this three-gene technology and with the impact of the corn acreage and how much is going in the corn. And I've heard him talk to Georgia growers many times. I'm just curious, as a panel and your concern as well, is what threat does the technology in the corn really across the belt focus on for cotton production and the longevity of being able to use those?
So for Louisiana, I'm recommending my growers don't plant any kind of three-gene corn. So we don't see an economic yield benefit to it. I've got non-BTs that can yield as well as three-gene. You know, we, as far as keeping that technology out of corn to preserve it in cotton, is where, you know, my stance, and I think the rest of the Mid-South would agree, but I'll let Angus speak on that. So, no, I don't believe that. You know, we need the three. We don't need the VIP cut technology in corn for corn earworm.
I'm not going to comment on it other than say that I think the entire panel across the cotton belt is in agreement on this point. And I'm going to let Angus or somebody.
Well, I'm going to say something for Tex, because there we do see some benefit from the VIP corn. We get fumonisin and. And when the VIP corn just tends to have less incidence of fumonisin. So there is some benefit there. I still hate to see it, because we all pretty much agree that what the BT corn is driving resistance. And I think as we see the VIP corn acreage increase, then we're probably going to see, you know, potential erosion of the VIP technology as that goes up. So that is a concern for us, for sure.
I'm going to try to be brief, Bobby. You hit my hot-button topic. It basically is exactly what David said for us. In our geography, greater than 90% of the whole bollworm population in the month of July is funneling through corn. If you have that trait and you push that big of a population through corn, you're selecting. And cotton will be the recipient of it after that generation, and you've got to think that it's going to play a huge role and screwing the cotton down the road. It's going to happen. It's going to happen, no doubt. We've been on record saying it. I could talk about this forever. It is a soapbox of mine, but I'm going to tell you it's going to be a problem, and cotton will be punished by what we're doing in corn for no economic advantage of controlling corn earworm in field corn.
I've got a question that I would like to ask. We're getting pretty close to time, but Jeremy touched on a little bit about the new Ligus trait, Thrips trait, Thrive On, I think is what it's going to be called. What impacts do y'all think this technology will have in y'all's states going forward? And I'm not sure when it's going to be released. I think, is it next year we'll see it a lot? Maybe a little bit this year? I'm not sure. But 21-22. And so it's right around the corner for us. But if we've got two or three more minutes, if y'all want to throw out some comments or ideas.
Sure, I'll be quick for South Carolina. As I mentioned, we won't need it broadly for the Ligus part of it. We'll need it for thrips. If we lose the neonics and lose total efficacy there and some of the other products become unavailable, that trait will be fantastic for us for thrips in South Carolina.
It definitely has a fit in Louisiana. I know it'll help us with the Ligus pressure as well as thrips. And so we don't see some of the resistance issues that some of my colleagues see and other with different technology in the Mid-South, different insecticides. But for one thing, it does.